The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jamie Raskin. I'm the director of the program on law and government. This is our first event for the new semester. We got a terrific lineup of events coming this semester, including later in January, discussion of voting rights and democracy after the Namunno case, a discussion about the state of the Justice Department in February, and later in the semester, a bunch of interesting things, including about the Supreme Court confirmation process, and a program called We the Corporations, which will be an analysis of the Citizens United case, which will be handed down any day by the Supreme Court. Today, we are really delighted to bring you this discussion, Lawyers Fiddle While the Constitution Burns, by two of America's leading lawyers, intellectuals, and citizen activists, Ralph Nader and Bruce Fein. I'm going to introduce them briefly. We will give each of them 20 minutes to open to set forth their thesis, and then we will open it up to discussion, and we're going to go until 2 o'clock. Let's see. Bruce Fein may be a little less familiar to you. I should say that both of what unites the Bruce Fein and Ralph Nader is that both of them are figures who have at various points in their careers been the absolute darlings of the conservative and liberal establishments respectively, and have found themselves also at various times as complete pariahs and outcasts for railing against what they see as the orthodoxies and the hypocrisies of those very same establishments. So they've led both of them completely fascinating careers, absolutely at the cutting edge of public events and public life. Bruce Fein has served in federal government in a number of different capacities, including as Assistant Director of the Office of Legal Policy at DOJ, as General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, as Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and recently he was on the ABA's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. At the same time that he has served in high-ranking places in Republican administrations, he's also called for the impeachment of President Nixon, President Clinton, and President Bush and Cheney. He's frequently quoted in the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, Newsweek. You can find all of his numerous writings, op-eds, and so on. He's written several books about the U.S. Supreme Court. His current book is called Constitutional Peril, which will be, I think, the basis for some of his remarks here today, and his forthcoming work that he's at work on now is called The American Empire Before the Fall. He's been an adjunct scholar with the American Enterprise Institute and a resident scholar at the Heritage Foundation, a lecturer at Brookings, and an adjunct professor at GW. Please welcome Bruce Fein. Now, Ralph Nader really needs no introduction, although that didn't prevent my office from printing out 11 pages of his CV here. But let me say this. Ralph, perhaps single-handedly, created the consumer movement in the United States. The whole reason that we have something called a consumer rights or consumer advocacy movement is because of Ralph Nader and work that he did as a very young man, really beginning back in law school when he wrote his senior paper about auto safety, and that became his famous book, Unsafe at Any Speed. And he has repeatedly pushed the public interest and the civic interest in the face of ferocious both political and corporate opposition. His outstanding career has grown only more controversial over the last few presidential cycles when he decided to take on what he described as the two-party duopoly and made runs for president in 2004 and in 2000 and 2004. I'm getting my years confused. In 2008 as well, 2000, 2004, and 2008. Ralph has written, I think, nearly a dozen books, has had dozens more written about him and his work. His current work is called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, which is his first work of fiction. It's a kind of a fictional utopian fantasy in which the wealthiest people in the world get together and decide to try to save the rest of the world from big corporations. And it's been receiving rave reviews, and he's going across the country and talking about this and about the political meaning of it. So Ralph continues to want to challenge and provoke always law students and the young to be engaged, which is why he proposed that he and Bruce Fein come today to talk to the best and the brightest of the new generation to talk about your responsibilities as lawyers in the current situation. So please welcome Ralph Nader. And I'm going to invite Bruce Fein to kick us off, and the clock is running. Bruce, you got 20 minutes or so, and then Ralph, and then we're going to open it up.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for those effusions. You need to remember in the audience, nothing that the moderator says is under oath. I'd like to begin with the opening words of my new book. It's the best of times for the American empire. It's the worst of times for the American republic. Now, why are we confronting a crisis? It's not the leaders, it's us. The American people need to develop and enforce a political culture that will demand adherence to the Constitution, otherwise it will become trashed. And before I get into the, I think, rather endless litany of the gross constitutional violations ongoing that make us a global power that every day is committing human rights abuses and defiling the rule of law, let's think about our own history and what happened when the American people defaulted on a comparable obligation after the Civil War to develop a political culture that would enforce the Civil War amendments. We had a century of Jim Crow. The words of the Constitution didn't change at Brown against the Board of Education. Those long years from Reconstruction to 1954 were years when white supremacists simply ruled by the political culture. And you would say separate but equal, even though it was a mockery. It was, in some sense, an oxymoron, was accepted as constitutional law. And the reason why it prevailed was because the culture was decadent, not because the text was deficient. And that's what I think we confront today with regard to enforcing and upholding the Constitution and the rule of law. And let me try to enumerate the abuses in 20 minutes, which will be difficult. Perhaps the most egregious is that we now have preemptive war, presidential wars, even though the Constitution clearly, if there's any provision that's clear, I don't know what it is, intended that only Congress could exercise the authority to initiate war against a foreign country. Indeed, and Congress never contemplated initiating war against a tactic as opposed to a country, because a tactic has no geographical limits, it has no duration, so it means perpetual war everywhere, which is where we are with regard to war against international terrorism. But just think now of where we are with regard to the wars in Iraq, which was not a war that was initiated by Congress. It spread into Pakistan, it's lasted longer than all of World War II, and we still don't have any authority from we the people for the president to be undertaking this endeavor. And yet there's total and complete complacency. No one stands up in the public and says, we can't have our men and women go to war that hasn't been properly and legally declared. And the reason why the Founding Fathers insisted in Article 1, Section 8, that only Congress be endowed with the authority to initiate wars, their entire experience with King George III and his contemporaries, with his executive branches inflating danger to justify war so they could get, what, more taxes, more power, and especially the glory to having transformed the world. That's intoxicating in the White House. You're the most powerful man in the world, then you need to leave something in the history books. You don't worry about minimum wage. You don't worry about family leave. That's just kind of garden, the weeds that presidents deal with. You want to change the world. And that's what clearly went on in the Bush administration. It was on the Nixon administration. It has gone on in all presidential administrations, going back to James K. Polk when he lied about Mexican forces having killed an American soldier on American soil in order to get us into the Mexican-American War, a total and complete lie that he later confessed to. But that's the reason why the Founding Fathers insisted only Congress can make this decision. Cannot hand it off to the president, cannot hand off to any other entity. What happened in Iraq is the Congress, Democrats, Republicans alike, said, Mr. Bush, you decide whether you think you need to invade Iraq because Saddam Hussein is a wretch. We don't want to decide that. And Joe Biden proclaimed that he was very proud that he was the architect of this compromise. And it passed overwhelmingly. And the case was never, cases were tried to get litigated in courts, but they were thrown out for the lack of standing, almost an insurmountable hurdle in these kinds of cases. The same reason why the constitutionality of the Vietnam War was never finally adjudicated, even though it as well was initiated through a delegation, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, to the president decide to fight in Vietnam, even though it became known that it was based upon lies about North Vietnamese patrol boats shooting at American ships. That's just one instance. Now we're not only in Iraq, we're in Afghanistan, we're fighting a war there, we're fighting a war now in Pakistan, although it's sort of an undeclared war, chasing after anyone we call Al-Qaeda or Taliban. There's no congressional authority for this kind of initiation. And indeed, it's become so customary to accept the president has the sole authority to initiate war that it's debated at the highest levels without question. You may recall that during the 2008 presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton boasted on ABC News that if Mr. Ahmadinejad and Iran attacked Israel, she would obliterate Iran if she was president. No one said, well, how can you do that? You don't have authority to act on your own. The Constitution endows that authority to Congress alone. It wasn't even an issue that was raised. When President Obama gave his Orwellian Nobel Peace Prize address, what did he say? Me, like other leaders, have the right unilaterally to defend the United States and to intervene for humanitarian reasons. You know, Congress doesn't even get a cameo appearance. Not only does it not get a cameo appearance, no one in Congress complains. So, yeah, that's right. We don't want to exercise that power. We want to give it away. If something goes wrong, we'll just blame the president. We will not exercise that authority. And one of the reasons why Congress has become so effete is because we let them. You let them, we let them. They get elected. There's no punishment for yielding all this power to the president to get reelected time after time. There's no consequences because the American people have now embraced the psychology of empire. Anything done in the name of national security, okay, make us safe. Don't make us responsible, make us safe. That's why there's no penalty. Congress, I can guarantee you, is not going to act unless they get emails into their offices. I know they will react if the people stood up. I was there the first day of the bailout vote in the House of Representatives, which went down. That was because there are thousands of emails in, don't bail out the banks, but on war and peace, nothing. So get after them. We'll have troops in Yemen soon. There won't be any Somalia, because the theory is anytime we suspect a terrorist anywhere, out comes the military. 10,000 troops. 50,000 troops, 100,000 troops, predator drones, enemy combatants, prisoners of war. It doesn't matter whether they're 13 years old, 23-year-olds, whatever. This is a national security empire state, and nobody in Congress, the public doesn't get up and says, no, there must be some risk if we have a free society. If you're trying to eliminate all risk, we're all in prison. We have to take some risk, reasonable risk. There's no reason why we cannot use criminal justice conspiracy cases like it's done from time immemorial to stop threats before they begin. But if you want to reduce risk to zero, then have a state of vassals and serfs, because that's the only way you can have it done. There's going to be Virginia Techs. There's going to be Timothy McVeighs. You can't eliminate that possibility in toto. But when it comes to war these days and empire, nah, you just say we're going after terrorists, all law falls to the side. Now, this is just one example of where the War Power Clause has clearly been violated. But just think about the other ones. We've got the enemy combatants. Now, this is a truly strange creature of law, which is, again, an oxymoron. An enemy combatant is said to be somebody who's so dangerous you can't release them, but he's so bereft of any incriminating evidence you can't convict them of anything. I remember reading about that. My first encounter was with Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago. Sound like Soviet justice. This is the United States of America. George Bush, Mr. Obama, they're all the same. They're all the same. I remember the debate in Congress recently about whether we had authorized any movement of the inmates at Guantanamo from there into the United States. Oh, we can't do that. They're all guilty as heck. They're terrorists. Well, they haven't had any trials yet. You know, this is even better than the Queen of Hearts and Alice in Wonderland, sentence first, verdict afterwards. And this comes from the United States Congress. That is exactly the attitude. They're all guilty. We can't do anything. The Yemenis now, we can't send them ever back to Yemen because we know they're guilty even though they haven't had a trial. Now, that's truly strange, but this enemy combatant status is a monstrosity that is a relic of empires and tyrannies. But let's go beyond, well beyond that. We have a president now who operates under a cloak of secrecy. We have the absurdity of the president of the United States saying his social secretary is immune from questioning by Congress over the party crashers, separation of powers, executive privilege. This is crazy. I mean, I was right at the Justice Department when John Dean, the White House counsel, was testifying for the Senate Watergate Committee, and he was relating blow-by-blow accounts of conversations he had in the White House with Richard Nixon. And no one said, oh, executive privilege, can't talk, Oval Office conversations. It wasn't even debated. And that was what ultimately brought the president down and the destruction of the slogan that's now been resurrected, if the president does it, it's legal. Not in the United States, it's not. And that's hardly the first time. You remember previously, Harriet Myers and Joshua Bolton and then Karl Rove, they got congressional subpoenas to testify about the discharge of 9 U.S. attorneys. They didn't even show up. Said, sorry, you don't want to show up. There's an absolute privilege to just sneer at Congress. Even the Fifth Amendment, you're supposed to appear and just refuse to answer questions on an individualized basis that might incriminate you. Similarly, that typically happens in executive privilege cases. You don't have a privilege to deny what your name is, where your address is. They didn't show up. That claim's never been repudiated. And say, I mean, maybe soon that the janitors will claim executive privilege. Again, it is shows how much the empire has taken hold. I was there with the Clinton impeachment proceedings. The Secret Service was testifying about trysts with Monica Lewinsky. Secret Service can testify, and the Social Secretary cannot. So we now have a situation where there virtually is no congressional oversight. Congress knows what the administration wants it to know, and no more. That's the beginning and the end. And without any oversight, the abuses flourish. We clearly understand that. I was around and involved in the Church Committee hearings in 75 and 76 that investigated 40 years of unilateral executive control, the FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, and uncovered just scores of abuses based upon those secret efforts. Remember, we were trying to assassinate Castro, Lumumba, and others, intercepting illegal conversations, mail, even from members of Congress because they were protesting the Vietnam War. And that is what led to many of the so-called reforms, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. Now, the presidents do the same thing with impunity. Congress makes no objection whatsoever. Indeed, you know what the current practice is? When the president briefs the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, no one else gets to know about these covert operations or special exemptions from the law, like terrorist surveillance program. They tell the members, you can't have any staff here and you can't talk to anybody about this. Your husband, your sister, your staff. And you know what? The members say, okay, we'll be sheep. We're your vassal. No protest whatsoever. Now I went up there, I won't mention names, and I talked to them. How can this be? There's a speech or debate clause, Article 1, Section 6 in the Constitution. You have an absolute right in any committee, in any floor jurisdiction, to say whatever you want with impunity. That's what the clause was given for, so you wouldn't be intimidated by the executive branch. Oh, that exists? We just can't do that. Then they won't tell us anymore. Well, then hold them in contempt. Don't confirm them. Cut off their salaries. Oh, we can't do that. We're just sheep. We're just too droopy. We don't have it in our DNA. I mean, it's truly scandalous. And this is not, I mean, if I was inflating and engaging in a caricature, I'd be happy, but it's not. This is exactly the kind of attitude you encounter up there. We just can't do it. The president has to take care of us. And, of course, we know secrecy breeds wrongdoing. Now, it's not only the executive privilege. Now, when we try to go to court and expose some of the constitutional transgressions, now you encounter the state secrets privilege. Let me just give you one example. There is an individual who was kidnapped in Macedonia. He was a German citizen. He was then taken to Afghanistan. He was abused for several months. He was dumped back on Albania. And then he ultimately, he was never found to have any complicity with al-Qaeda at all. And he brought suit against George Tenet, 26 members of the CIA and operatives who he claimed violated his rights of due process, Fourth Amendment, etc. Case gets argued up to the Fourth Circuit, the district court there as well, and the administration, both Obama and Bush, say state secrets privilege prevents you from litigating your case. And the reasoning is rather straightforward. These are all covert operatives. And state secrets protects sources and methods. And if you disclose who the culprits are, it'll disclose spies. And therefore, they have to get off scot-free. I said, well, how about if they killed him? You know, and you disclose that the assassin was a covert agent. State secrets. Can't move forward. You know, so basically, the state secrets privilege, as interpreted by Bush and Cheney and accepted by the courts, is a license to commit the most heinous crimes just by covert operatives, sources and methods. So we can't talk about whether we communicated with the Germans or the Italians or the Egyptians to kill anybody or torture them that we sent them, because that would disclose cooperation between intelligence agencies and sources and methods. I mean, this is in a rule of law. The state secrets doctrine is itself lawlessness. It's lawlessness. And it all stems from this concocted case in the Civil War period where a spy who made a contract to perform service for Abe Lincoln came in afterward and said, you didn't pay me. The Totten case. And that breach of contract case now has been interpreted and inflated in the empire psychology to mean the administration, the executive branch, can commit most flagrant constitutional violations with impunity. And you just raise state secrets and everything goes away. Everything goes away. Now, where this really turns logic in the Constitution on its head is who has the greatest obligation of all others to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States? The government. When I was in the government, I took an oath. One oath, not to the president. You know, this isn't Nazi Germany. You take an oath to the Fuhrer. To the Constitution of the United States. That's your only loyalty. Your only loyalty. The president has to take it. Every member of the executive branch has to take it in Congress. So that we are dealing with people who have flouted the Constitution in violation of their oath. They had a duty more than anyone else to be scrupulous and turn square corners. They flout it and they get off scot-free. They get off scot-free of the state secrets doctrine. Now, those are the most egregious violations of the Constitution. Now, there are many subsidiary ones that formerly might be egregious, but it's all a hierarchy now. Like the President Obama continues to issue these signing statements. I was on the task force that wrote a huge report showing how they're unconstitutional. George Washington, the very first president, and remember he did preside over the Constitutional Convention, so he has some insight into what it meant, said clearly, as a president, I have two choices when I'm presented with a bill. Veto it or sign it. He may do neither and just let it lapse for 10 days and then it becomes a law if he didn't want to sign. But he doesn't have a choice to write signing statements or to veto part of it. And indeed, the Supreme Court itself held in Clinton versus New York, Congress couldn't even by delegation authorize line item veto authority. But presidents now, claiming necessity, emergency, that's the routine mantra whenever you want to violate the Constitution, says, no, if the bill is really long, you know, and I like a lot of it, but not just parts that I don't like. I'll just say, these parts are unconstitutional, I won't enforce them. And I won't send it back to Congress, and hey, line item veto, immune from any congressional rebuke, immune from judicial rebuke, and hey, this is a way in which I can get my own law. President Bush did this on thousands of occasions. For example, on one provision, the Intelligence Oversight Act said, the president cannot utilize our military in Colombia to fight FARC or narco-terrorist groups. And so Bush writes this signing statement and says, oh, I think you're interfering with my authority as commander-in-chief, so I'll just treat the mandatory language as advisory. That you want me to do that, but if I don't want to, I don't really have to. And Obama has done the same thing with his signing statements, although recently, if you read the story by Charlie Savage in the New York Times, instead of doing the signing statements himself, he subcontracts at the Office of Legal Counsel where I used to work, so they do the de facto signing statement after the fact so it doesn't look so politically unappealing. But he said, no, Congress cannot require me to get a certification from my defense secretary that utilizing U.S. forces under U.N. command or meeting with state sponsors of terrorism only with the authority of the recommendation of the Secretary of State, they encroach on my authority and I simply will not obey those statutes. And we go to the general provisions of the Constitution relating to executive authority to prevent any disclosure of presidential communications or something that goes under executive privilege. Here, the president, like Bush Cheney, basically take the position that any time that he talks, that anybody in the White House talks to anybody else, that's a privileged communication that can be withheld from Congress. And therefore, we'll never know exactly what he was talking about and what advice he's receiving about sending 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. Remember that there's not a single syllable in the Constitution that says anything about executive privilege, authority to withhold any information from Congress ever. And the Supreme Court has never upheld any withholding from Congress of any executive branch communication. Because Congress, for instance, needs to know, it seemed to me if I'm a member, they need to know what advice the president was getting from his defense people, his Secretary of State, CIA, in determining whether they should vote money to send more troops to Afghanistan. They need to know that advice. And yet under the current theory, no, they operate in the dark. The president monopolizes all of that money. Government openness is indispensable if we're going to have a true democracy. What does it mean when it says government by the consent of the governed in the Declaration of Independence? What does that mean? It means you need to know what the government is doing in order to hold it accountable and decide whether you need to shift your loyalties. If it's all done in the dark, how can you approve or oppose it? We didn't know whether there was a terrorist surveillance program. We didn't know torture and other interrogation abuses until leaks to the newspapers. That's not the way the system's supposed to work. Congress is failing, but the American people are failing too. We're not demanding that Congress do anything. We vote for members who will simply be wallpaper on the congressional floor and do nothing to exercise their oversight. Now, where do we go from here? And I apologize for probably overstaying my welcome, but here is where the lawyers have a special responsibility. Because we know, and remember, I didn't do archaeological expedition to find out what the Founding Fathers intended and what the Constitution means. You can read it in Eliot's debates, Madison's notes, Farrand's notes, Supreme Court decisions, Federalist Papers, etc. It means that we have a duty to speak up, to try to lead in local areas, writing letters to the editor, writing into members of Congress, organizing groups within bar associations to make a protest against this American empire psychology. We are going the same way as all empires have. We will overreach, and it may not collapse on our heads. Remember when Rome was sacked in 410 AD, it wasn't because those who were there at 408 didn't do anything. It was because those 100 years earlier did nothing. So we have an obligation to be worried about posterity because they're not going to inherit anything close to democracy or even the freedoms we have. Each day, the circle gets narrower and narrower of our freedoms. Each day, the flimsiness of the claims for national security to curtail all our liberties grows wider and wider. So you as lawyers, in your studies, in your professional obligations, and just as a civic leader, have a duty to lead the way and to understand what's going on. You need to insist that your curriculum teach this first. All the idea of rule of law is going out the window. All your mastery of tax law is irrelevant if you don't have rule of law at all. What do you think a tax lawyer earns in Russia? You know, Mr. Khodorkovsky had a great tax lawyer. Did it do him any good? Nothing. Now, I say, you've got to have a sense of fear and anticipation because we're not quite there yet. But it was Madison, the father of the Constitution, said, we need to be alarmed at the very first encroachment on our liberties. And I'll conclude by just trying to give an example from our own history that shows the importance of rebelling about the concepts themselves even before they're implemented. You may recall that after the stamp tax, there was a big revolt and furor, not only about the tax itself, no taxation without representation, but no general writs of assistance to come in to try to discover who the scofflaws might be. And when the British Parliament then repealed the stamp tax as a political favor, they also simultaneously passed the Declaratory Act. It reiterated saying, we may have repealed the Tax Act, but we retain all power, omnipotent power to rule over the colonies without any input for them whatsoever. It was that Declaratory Act that said, we're not taking the stamp tax or we're not just taking that as acceptable. They have now asserted in theory the right to treat us as vassals, and the revolt began, as John Adams said. Well, thank you for being so attentive and coming out today. It's really a wonderful experience to see so many people engaged on something that's more than drivel or Michael Jackson or whoever else hits the headline. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you. Okay, Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much, Jamie and Bruce, for your fire in the belly, remarks. Because without fire in the belly, what we all know doesn't get actuated. And we become increasingly removed from reality. And we operate on myths, like most societies do, that allow concentration of power. You cannot concentrate power and become an authoritarian society unless you spread and entrench myths, such as the rule of law, such as the president is not above the law, is not beyond the law, etc. Rosa Parks was not the only one who knew what was going on in Montgomery, Alabama, but she had fire in her belly. The sit-down strikers in Flint, Michigan, before World War II, trying to form the United Auto Workers, put their entire livelihoods and their family on the line. They had fire in their belly. That's what you've got to get in law school. Now, there's no other law school I know that has more exciting speeches and conferences on more important things than AU Law School. Harvard doesn't, Yale doesn't, Georgetown doesn't. You ought to take advantage of it. So never again will there be an empty seat in a room like this. Because if you don't watch it, the craftsmanship of going to law school can turn you into a drone. And drones have poured out of law school for years. We have 1 million practicing lawyers in this country. And how many of them have spoken up against the outrageous, entrenched criminal illegalities of corporations and governments wedded into a corporate state, which is a definition of fascism? How many? Most of them wouldn't even know the difference between a lawyer and an attorney. Have you ever had in your class a discussion or out of class the difference between a lawyer and an attorney? Anybody? Okay, an attorney attorneys for a client, zealous representation and all that. A lawyer looks out for the overall system of justice and administration of justice, and not just in the courts. Now, ideally, an attorney and a lawyer will be the same person with different commitments and allegiances. Unfortunately, the law school curriculum, competing against other law school curriculums, tends to reflect the job market, tends to be very occupational and not very professional. There's quite a difference between lawyers as a trade and lawyers as a profession. As a profession, they take the bigger picture, they try to deal with reality, they try to deal with prevention of conflict, prevention of injustice. If they fail, that's when the lawyers come in, ideally, to represent aggrieved clients. Now, back in the University of Chicago days, when Judge Posner was teaching, he may be still teaching, how many of you have read Judge Posner's opinions? And no one has written more, I guess. He writes a book every 9 months in his spare time. He was an adjunct at University of Chicago. This is an eyewitness student account. And the first day of class, he walked in, and he nodded to the students. And he turned around and he wrote on the blackboard the word justice. And then he turned around and he looked at the students and he said, "You see that word?" And they said, "Yes." He said, "That's the last time I want to hear it in my class." That's the law and economics school of theology. That's the empirically starved law and economics school that pretends brilliance because they use mathematical equations and regression analysis. But that's what's been taught to tens of thousands of law students all over the country. And I want you to try to look at the history of the law at its finest moments and your student predecessors at their finest moments during the civil rights struggle, the anti-Vietnam War struggle, the environmental advance, Earth Day, 1970, etc., and ask yourself whether it's not your time to put your arm to the wheel of justice and carry forward. As law students, you grossly underestimate your ability to raise idealistic and realistic issues by taking common stands within law schools and between law schools, which is now facilitated by the Internet. If the law students spoke out against corporate crime, they spoke out against illegal criminal wars of aggression, there would be people who would listen. It would invigorate many of the law professors, too, who have given up on you other than trying to get a good score in the class. They think they're more radical than you are or more progressive. But they need to be jolted, too, as they were in the 60s and the 70s, to enliven a curriculum which I never was able to take advantage of when I was at Harvard Law School in the 50s. In the 50s, the curriculum was so disgracefully aversive to the reality of injustice in our country that we never saw it. There was no civil rights courses, no women's rights courses, no poverty courses, no consumer protection courses, and no environmental courses. There was no course on corporate crime. There were courses on securities laws and Delaware corporations and tax laws and tax seminars, etc. Exactly what the corporate law firms wanted the law students to be trained in. As a result, we didn't learn much about history or jurisprudence. I hope that you will never decide not to take a course here because it doesn't help you on the bar exam. The bar exam is eminently crammable in more than one way. They have bar review courses that are so instrumental, their only wish in life is to make sure that every one of you passes the bar, given what they charge for it. So don't say you don't want to take jurisprudence or you don't want to take legal history because it's not tested in a bar exam. And just let me example. How many of you have ever heard of Willard Hurst? Willard Hurst. Willard Hurst? One? Two? Willard Hurst? Okay. Arguably the leading legal historian, professor of law at Wisconsin in the 20th century. None of you have heard of him. Now, you think if there were a classroom full of physics students, and I said, how many of you have heard of Isaac Newton? Well, anybody not raise their hand? So it's very important to understand legal history for all the reasons you and I and everybody knows. But it's also important for you to start asking the kind of questions that are not in your case books and your textbooks. I want to give you a few examples of what it was like in a very telling moments when I was at law school. One day, a law professor trying to acculturate the law students, you know, into the pantheon of Harvard Law School heroes. So one of the jokes was that at Harvard, in the morning, they distort the law of contracts, and in the afternoon, they contract the law of torts. And we went, oh, boy, who would understand that other than law students? We really chortled, you know? Well, it turned out it was quite a prediction, because now we have seen more than a few years of contracting the law of torts, called tort reform, grotesquely, or distorting the law of contracts, mainly contracts of adhesion, which we all sign supinely on the dotted line, and allow private corporate legislatures to take us out of the courts, binding arbitration, and in other ways to destroy our freedom of contract, which is one of the pillars of our legal system. So the second story I want to tell you is I was in constitutional law class, and the question was, why did the jury decide the way it did in a criminal case in Texas? And the professor said, okay, who wants to start? And like 20 hands shot up. These were large attendance, 150 students in a course, in a class. And he just shot everyone down with the usual, you know, 1L movie type. Ridiculous! Foolish! What'd you eat last night? Did you sleep 10 minutes? And he just shot them all down. All their ideas as to why this jury decided the way it did were not acceptable to him. In the back of the room, there was one guy there, only 15 women and 550 students. But remember, the professors were the best and the brightest. And if you didn't believe it, all you had to do was ask them, right? And one of the things they said was, women just take up seats. They don't become practicing lawyers. They get married and have babies. So why have women in class? Remember, these were very brilliant law professors and deans. And I would hear this from time to time, which led me to write an article for the Harvard Law Record where I discovered that 11 states, including Maryland, prohibited women from serving on juries in 1957. It hasn't been that far away. So anyway, a fellow sitting in the back seat, and he had three strikes on him. One, he was out of his seat assignment location. Two, he didn't have a suit and coat and tie on. And three, he had the temerity to put his foot on the back of the chair in front of him. So he had his hand up, and the professor sort of snarled and said, "Yeah, you, what do you say?" And he said, "Professor, maybe the jury decided this way because it was all white." You could have heard a pin drop. The students turned around and looked at this pariah who had descended on the classroom with a dose of reality, right? Now, it was only about 4 years later that the Supreme Court started deciding that juries were not representatively selected, and that was a constitutional issue. Now, just think of this. That's why you could never accuse Harvard Law School of foresight, because you couldn't footnote it. You can't footnote foresight. See? So what are the comparable anecdotes today that are going on? Well, page one of the Washington Post, 13 months ago, had a big feature on Treasury Secretary Paulson. This was after the bailouts, bailout stage one. And he admitted to the reporter that he did not, quote, have the authorities to do what he did, end quote, but he did it anyway, because someone had to do it. There was no letter to the editor, no protests from law schools for this outrageous admission of massive illegality that burdened taxpayers from here to eternity with hundreds of billions of dollars of obligations. How's your blood pressure? If you're not getting a little bit indignant after you hear Bruce, something's wrong with you, because you're not connecting your mind and your sense of justice with fire in your belly. Now, when Robert Rubin, who tanked the system first by getting Clinton to deregulate banking, get rid of Glass-Steagall and the 1999 Act, and refused to regulate derivatives in the 2000 Act, then went to Citigroup, got $40 million for about 5 months of consultantship before he was given a formal post there, and he tanked Citigroup with his brilliant administration of that giant multinational bank. And just before it was going over the cliff, late 2008, he had a weekend meeting with Paulson and Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve. And Monday morning, without any congressional knowledge, input, authorization, or anything, they bailed out in a press release Citigroup with $45 billion infusion in preferred stock purchase and $360 billion in assumption of potential liabilities for their toxic assets. That's billion. Any protests from the bar? Any protests from law schools? What do you think Madison meant when he said the first encroachment? What would he have said on the 10th encroachment, the 100th encroachment? What is your breaking point before you break your routine and do something different as members of the legal profession which you became the moment you started law school. Doesn't mean you're an attorney. You are a member of the legal profession. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was so worried about concentration of corporate power that in 1938, he sent a request to Congress to set up a temporary National Economic Commission to investigate it with the following message. When government is controlled by private economic power, that is fascism. That's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We have had examples of prior presidents making similar comments, and yet the Supreme Court, in a rogue decision, in the 1880s, the Santa Clara Railroad decision out of California, concluded that the corporation, railroad, at least there's dispute as whether they said anything other than their head notes, which were written by a former railroad lawyer who was a scribe in those days. But anyway, it was interpreted by succeeding Supreme Court decisions that the Supreme Court said that that railroad was a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment equal protection of the laws. A person, huh? Well, that's news. The word corporation doesn't appear in our Constitution. The words political party don't appear in our Constitution. But we're ruled by both. How can somebody like Antonin Scalia, who was here once with Breyer, how can he rail against judicial activism and refuse to ever mention the Santa Clara case, which arguably is the most judicially active case in American history, because then it was off to the races. And then every right that you have under the Constitution as a pulsating human being who votes and bleeds is now given to the impersonal entity, the artificial person called the corporation, with one exception: the right against self-incrimination. The courts haven't yet crossed that line where they will allow Exxon before a congressional committee to plead as a corporation the Fifth Amendment. That's all that's left. What are the consequences of that? The consequences are that they have privileges and immunities because they are an artificial entity that can grow infinitely worldwide, that you don't have and never will have, no matter if you become a billionaire. And yet they have all the constitutional rights to fight against controls over tobacco advertising or to fight against differential modes of taxation or to fight against what should be a proper constitutional assertion, which is to prevent them from lobbying, from engaging in political activity, or from directly or indirectly engaging in campaign contributions to political candidates. Only human beings should have constitutional rights, not artificial entities. The result is that the corporation now can claim all kinds of constitutional rights against certain regulations and even inserts in billing envelopes that are designed to give you a right to be informed and join your own consumer groups. Even that is considered a violation of the corporation's constitutional right under the First Amendment to remain silent and not rebut the insert. How's that one for you? Whenever any of you meet over lunch with anthropologists who teach you about the animisms of tribes in New Guinea, which give animistic qualities to rocks and trees, consider that no tribe anywhere in the world can approximate the level of animism that we have ascribed to the corporation. And so now you can get Blackwaters, you can get incipient death squads in the formation, because the government has contracted out state functions, right down to assassinations and military operations, to corporations in this country, continuing under Barack Obama. That's why you can get the most outrageous assertions accepted on Capitol Hill, because they have bought into corporate personhood and equal protection under the law between all of you and the corporation. There is a difference, isn't there, between you and a corporation, but it's not recognized constitutionally. Now, you've got about 15,000 days before you start contemplating retirement. Little over 2,000 weeks. Did last week go quickly? So how are you going to spend your time? Let's assume you're an accomplished attorney. You have opportunities to join law firms, which will pay you quite well to go against workers, taxpayers, consumers, anyone that challenges their corporate clients. And year after year, as you sink in opportunity cost philosophies, you will become a victim of your own trivialization of your talents. You will not be advancing justice. You will not be working as lawyers. You'll be working as attorneys in ever more narrow cul-de-sacs, making a lot of money. There isn't 5 out of 500 lawyers who will escape that trap, apart from those who become law professors. And the question is whether you're going to escape that trap, whether you are going to anticipate the final chapter of the institutionalization of autocracy and the burial of what's left of our constitutional rights. We should never confuse personal freedom with civic freedom, which is the problem with most people in most countries. There are personal freedoms in dictatorships. We have a lot of personal freedoms. We can eat what we want, dress how we want, date who we want, marry who we want, travel where we want, pick the music we want to hear, turn on the TV when we want, get into a 5,000-pound vehicle and go down 3 blocks to buy some chiclets if we want. That's not civic freedom. You know what civic freedom is. Civic freedom is having a role in preserving constitutional systems and enlarging them. Civic freedom is having a role in telling a criminal president that he's not going to lie his way into the invasion of Iraq and 1 million dead Iraqis and thousands of U.S. soldiers later. Civic freedom is having a role in redressing a grotesque tax system. Civic freedom is having a role in allowing more voices and choices on the ballot and breaking a two-party tyranny that tells all the voters you just have two choices, however narrow they've become, because the laws are excluding third-party and independent candidates. Civic freedom is having the ability to change the curriculum so students learn civic skills, so they learn civic experience, so they don't become what Bruce called vassals or serfs. Would they become vassals? But it all starts with your own self-respect. You come out of this law school with probably more reality because of your professors and your dean than most students in the 170 other law schools around the country. You have conferences here on human rights and other abuses that you should attend, because that's part of your real education. Your courses may be part of your training. Sometimes they're part of your legal education if you have a good professor. But it's your extracurricular activities that you are involved in your own groups, which you have here, as well as the people who visit here, that you need to expand. Our responsibility, our generation's responsibility, is to expand the opportunity for public interest law writ large. So you can have full-time careers in public interest law and still pay your bills. We have tried that with my law school class 58 under the Appleseed Foundation that has offices in Washington. Look them up. They've started centers for law and justice in 16 states. That's one law school class started that. Your law school class is 30, 35 years out. Should be brought here during alumni reunions. And you should meet with the people in Appleseed and see what kind of institution you want to build out of that. You should have a seminar in institution building so you learn how to create new kinds of nonprofit or other advocacy groups that will provide opportunity for you to work in. New kinds of checkoffs for banks and insurance companies and landlords where people can voluntarily join through the facility of these checkoffs and form their regional or national organizations. New kinds of ways for CyPRE distributions. There are tens of millions of dollars that have very little imagination behind them, that cannot find a location in terms of the victims. And so they're sent to soft charities. They're not even sent to start groups or to groups that are trying to prevent the very abuse that the class action was brought to hold accountable. So let me just end on this point, and we can have a good discussion with all of us. The criminal laws do not stop ever when the president and vice president leaves office. This country has got to bring Bush and Cheney to justice. How it can be brought to justice by a criminal president succeeding them who is on his way to becoming a recidivist war criminal is a challenge for the most brilliant law students and law professors. But it's got to start with people's sense of gross injustice. The violence that is being committed in your name and our name every day, the slaughters, the assassinations, the blowing up of wedding parties, the blowing up of innocent civilians because they see through some drone maneuvered by someone who goes 9 to 5 in Nevada office for the military and pushes buttons because there's one suspect and they'll blow up a whole area by pushing a button. That ought to offend us. It ought to offend us not just philosophically and legally. It ought to offend us because it is going to come back to haunt us. We are a very vulnerable society. I'm sure the national security types are wondering why we haven't been struck more often. Our subways are vulnerable. Our pipelines are vulnerable. Our dams are vulnerable. We are a very vulnerable society. Our chemical plants are vulnerable to anyone who wants to commit suicide. And there are plenty that we're creating more and more fertile soil for. It's what, in effect, a national security fellow said once, not long after 9/11. He said, we've got to respond in ways that don't create more of them. We have responded and exaggerated and elaborated and produced civilian casualties and blown up whole areas in ways that creates more of them. And do you want to live in a society where there's a terrorist attack every week? Once the regime gets professionalized and nothing else is paid attention to? So just from your own self-interest, the rule of law is the rule of safety. It's the rule of health. It's the rule of protection of your children and your grandchildren. It is not just a luxury. It is not just something that we can say to our forebears, yeah, we stood up for you guys. It's a survival mechanism. And it comes down to what you think of your own self-respect and the self-confidence you have to take the leadership. Leadership does not have to be numerous. It has to be authentic, it has to be steadfast, and it has to be correct. And once you become leaders, you'll find you'll be creating a lot of other leaders as you go through your professional life. Michael Greco was a corporate lawyer and became president of the American Bar Association. Something happened to him in 2005, 2006. He commissioned three studies that he sent to President Bush, charging him with significant constitutional violations. What happened to Michael Greco? Why did he become the only ABA president, the most conservative bar association in the Western world, to stand up to the president? He got fire in his belly. Never forget that. Never be satisfied with the feeling that because you know what the score is and because you know what the reality is, somehow that's enough, because you've decreed yourself not ignorant and knowledgeable. You've got to have fire in your belly. If you come out of this room after the discussion without a higher temperature, I'll leave you with this suggestion. You've got serious problems. Thank you.
Okay, so the floor is open for questions now. You can either address it to Bruce or to Ralph, or please, Mazi.
My question is, coming from Africa and Nigeria, where the dictators have perfected the method of impoverishing people so that the lawyers and the doctors and all the professionals are so engaged in just surviving, daily surviving, that they don't even have the time to address social injustices. Now, you just opposed that to the United States, an average law student here and around the country comes out of law school with hundreds of thousands of debt. And that becomes an ice in your belly and can put out that fire you have, because it affects whether you buy a house, whether you buy a car, where you go, and what you do. Now, student loan is one of the areas that cannot be dischargeable in bankruptcy. And if somebody writes a check to pay for the rich people that write checks to pay for their students' education, they're not taxed for that. But if you write a check to transfer that cash to your child as a gift, they get taxed. So we have a massive transfer of wealth from the rich to their children that is not taxed and it's not attempted. And then you have masses of these students here, hundreds of thousands of loans that will make a dent on how you fight social injustice. In fact, even if you wanted to, it's not, you can put an ice in your head.
Yes, sir. You speak like you've been here all your life. You have loan forgiveness programs.
We do have a good one here.
Yeah. They need to be expanded. Rich law schools, for example, like Harvard and Yale, shouldn't charge tuition. They have huge endowments. Harvard's endowment is $1 billion, by the way. The law school alone is $1 billion.
Until Larry Summers took over the investment company, I think so.
Worked out a little bit. They're getting it back from us. The third goes to my point of creating opportunities. which so they don't have to go work at a minimum wage public interest job. And the fourth is to do something about the student loan companies, which are really very abusive. Sallie Mae is beginning to shift more to the Department of Education, I guess, now, in terms of the loans. But the people here, where's Oliver? Yeah, Oliver, he's over $100,000 in loans out of Boston University. It's like a never-ending necklace of debt. Keeps just growing. So, but he's doing public interest work. So while your point is well taken, it's not a total exoneration, because even if you work in a corporate law firm, there are things you can do inside and after hours as well, until you pay off your debt. The interesting thing is these law firms, I guess until recently, have been so overpaying their associates that you can pretty much pay off the debts in 5 years. And then what's their excuse, you see? So.
Yeah, I don't think that really is an excuse. Pakistan is not a wealthy country. It's in many ways like Nigeria, enormous distributional inequities. I've been in Nigeria. I worked with M.K. Abiola before they killed him. And I know Mr. Yaradua now may not be with us too much longer, and Voli Soyinka, who perhaps is somebody who could change things. But remember, in Pakistan, the lawyers were the ones who restored the rule of law, and they weren't pulling down $500,000 salaries. And it's not been true that every impoverished country automatically succumbs to despotism. I remember also in the 70s when Indira Gandhi was flouting the Indian Constitution, and India is a very impoverished country. People threw her out of office. The fact is, if you want to make time for it, you can make time for it. And that's the spirit. That's why we prevailed at Valley Forge, not because people said it's too cold, we don't have enough money.
Yep.
January 14th. It is open, the court room is open. So I, all of you who leave here with five in your belt, I encourage you to go to that courtroom and fill that courtroom. This January 14th. Now that proposition, I am arguing that proposition, is Gordon versus Biden. WWW, elect is not you. U.S., all the themes are there. To go to what you said, it is a brief, in the final brief, and I'm not going to be modest. I think that my final brief should be quiet reading for all of you. I'm not going to be modest about it. Because it not only argues the law, it argues the history that Brian talked about. That is what is read in that brief. And it says simply this. It's a very simple suit. There are states, there are five southern states that are subject of this suit, that grant their presidential electors on a winner-take-all basis, in which there is no winner-take-all state law or statute. They just do it on tradition. The suit is simple. Say, in that those states, you cannot dilute, you cannot abridge, you cannot amend the strength of minority poll votes. You must apportion your presidential electors on a basis of the proper split in these states where there is no state law to state otherwise.
Could we give us the website one more time just so people will know where to go to get more information?
Yes, the U.S. Court of Appeals.
What's the website?
www.electors.us.
Electors.us.org.
Electors.us.
Okay.
Gordon versus Biden.
Okay.
Now,
and then, just close up now so we can get a quick reaction then.
Just to close out, this addresses what contact your attorneys if you can't make it. Contact your attorneys and say, look, this is something that a Yale Judiciary Committee has said is the most amazing proposition that has been put forward. Go and support that action. Go yourself or send some of your law students to that.
Great.
So when those judges look out, they will not see something else to do.
Thank you so much. Thank you. More questions or any comments? Yes.
One is you should have more conversations with fellow students. In the 60s, there was a lot of person-to-person conversation. They didn't carry around little things in their hands and in their ears. And that's really a problem, you know, when you spend so much time in virtual reality or, you know, Twitter and this and that. It's really person-to-person, and you should have little discussion groups on things of common concern that arise out of your courses or out of your own concerns. The second is that we grow up thinking that there's only two parties, and that's it. Scholastic magazine in 08 floods millions of young kids with workbooks to try to get them interested in the congressional, in the presidential campaign. And they had Obama, and they had McCain, and no one else. And a 9-year-old boy wanted to vote for me in Western Minnesota. The teacher said, you can't vote for Nader. He said, why not? He said, but well, don't you see? There are only two in these materials. And his mother took over after that one. So it starts there, and a comparative reflection is in order. Canada has five parties. It got its single-payer health care, started out in Saskatchewan with a CCC party and then the NDP small party. And Norway has 8-9 parties. Chile has 8-9 parties. Western Europe. We have the most tyrannical duopoly in the Western world. It's harder to get on the ballot. It's harder to get your vote counted. It's harder to do anything outside the two parties in any other Western country in the world. So when people realize that, say, wow, you know, we're supposed to be the lead, right? We're supposed to be the tribune of democracy. So it helps to get people agitated that way. And finally, look at all the issues that are completely excluded by the two parties, and not just process issues. There are all kinds of things none of them talk about. As Bruce was saying in the last campaign, look at all the things Obama and McCain declined to talk about. They didn't have anything on their website on corporate crime. None of them wanted to talk about full Medicare for all. None of them wanted to talk about criminal wars of aggression. On and on and on. So they narrow what is discussed, and what is discussed is the limits of political dialogue. So you have to ask constantly, what are the areas of improvement in everybody's lives, like, you know, a decent wage and et cetera, living wage and so on. that is never discussed. But people do it to themselves. I've had people all over the country say they went in to vote for me, and they went out and they voted for one of the two candidates, major candidates. I said, why? He said, because we want to be with the winner. Even in places where they were slam dunk Republican states or Democrats. So it's in their mind, they're controlled by their own narrow perception and expectation level. So that's where we've got to do a lot of grassroots educating and agitating and start the third and fourth party efforts at the local level where it can succeed much more readily at the beginning.
Let me make a couple of observations. One, I think the far greater worry and alarm is the political culture. It's not the parties. It's the entire culture is so decayed and indifferent to constitutional violations. It's the empire psychology. We just need to dominate everybody because, hey, we're the United States and we get psychic thrill out of swagger. Who cares? I mean, it's not overt, but there's no doubt that an enormous percentage of the reasons why the rule of law has crumbled after 9/11 is because most of the victims have names we can't pronounce. Boumediene, Hamdi, they all sound foreign. It's not going to be us. The same reason why Japanese Americans were locked up in World War II. Who? Korematsu, Hirabayashi, that's not us. So there's an enormous amount of bigotry and prejudice that explains that, which is quite a disgrace. But it's the political culture more than the parties that is the problem. The other observation I'd like to make is that nothing will ever happen for good unless you stand up and devote a career, even in the bleakest of circumstances where you think you'll never succeed. And I think about William Lloyd Garrison. Remember, he started the Liberator newspaper in 1831 in Boston. He was going to campaign against slavery. He said the Constitution was a covenant with hell because it supported and endorsed slavery. And he was hung, tarred and feathered, driven out. You know, everyone said he's crazy. Why are you doing this? You'll never succeed. 1831, how are you going to succeed? Dred Scott was going to be 1857. Yet he was there in 1865 when the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery was signed and ratified. Look at those who started the Women's Suffrage Amendment in 1848, Seneca Falls. I mean, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they were dead by the time the 9th Amendment was finally ratified. You've got to stick to your principles and find that the effort and the process is its own reward, even if it fails. Look at how many people I'm sure we don't know about. Their anonymities that died in Czechoslovakia and China today and otherwise, they were just perished because they never had any success whatsoever facing these daunting odds. But that's what gives us spirit as human beings. We know we fight anyway, irrespective of what the odds are. I mean, that's why we're a little bit prideful of those who died at Thermopylae, even though they perhaps weren't fighting for democracy. But that's what has to be your lodestar in your own personal life. It doesn't matter whether it's going to succeed the next day. You know you have meaning to your life. And when you think about it, and I don't want to be morbid, think about what do you want on your epitaph. Do you want, well, listen, I had video games or whatever. You want to have that you actually stood behind some principle that has some enduring meaning.
The blasphemy of today is the commonplace of tomorrow. History is full of that.
So I see a bunch of hands. Let me take a few at a time, guys, and if you would just take notes on the things you want to comment on. Let me take Kate and these two guys, and then we'll come over here. Yeah.
Your own law
school. Oh, no. I have a time factor. It's hard to do all these things. But, Edgar Kahn started Antioch Law School, and Queens Law School was started to be a public interest law school in New York City. There have been efforts.
And this law school was created by suffragettes and early feminists, of course. You two guys, yeah. And wait, let's just get your question, too. The Wall Street bailout in the media?
On the Wall Street bailout, it's, well, the easy answer is say we should have bailed out the victims, not the perpetrators, and generated consumer demand, dealt with the mortgage restructuring. Instead, we bailed out AIG and Goldman Sachs, giving Goldman Sachs indirectly 100% return on as counterparties on these crazy derivatives. So. And rewarded Wall Street for doing it and still not regulating it so it could happen again and again because it's no skin off their nose. They're doing pretty well, personally, with their compensation packages. The other thing on is that the media is a function, first of all, of a growing awareness that needs to be generated of what we own as a commonwealth. We own the public lands, we own the public airwaves, we own public research and development, the drug companies, so, and we give it all away. The TV and radio stations control the airwaves. They pay us no rent for their license. The timber companies, gold companies, et cetera, control our resources. So once we, I tried to make this a major issue in the campaign, the commonwealth that people own, but corporations control, they legally own this commonwealth. This is the biggest wealth in the country. So they can have their own audience networks. They can have their own radio and TV stations by simply shaving off the amount of time they want during the day from the license, which is now 24 hours a day, to the TV and radio stations, and say, no, there's going to be 3 hours or whatever returned to the public under a structured way, which we have drafted in actual legislation and proposed to Congress. And who pays for these public interests? Who pays for these stations by simply charging the commercial radio and TV stations rent? They're getting billions of dollars of free public property use 24 hours a day, and they decide who says what and who doesn't. So you see, we have to get people to understand that they collectively own the greatest wealth in our country, including the pension funds, but they don't control anything. So you can see what an appeal that has even to conservatives, not just liberals.
Bruce,
Michael John, who is a famous First Amendment scholar, once said that the First Amendment was worried that everything worth saying shall be said rather than that everyone shall speak. And my greatest concern is the things that should be talked about aren't talked about at all, whether you have one or three or 25 outlets. In fact, I think, if anything, the new technologies make the media concentration problem far less pronounced. When Ralph and I were growing up, you had Walter Cronkite and Harry Smith and who was the guy, Dave Brinkley on NBC. That was it. Nothing else. Now your choices are multiples of what we encountered earlier. With regard to the bailout issue, I want to go back to the due process problem. You remember Henry Paulson, he's bailing out companies without any authority whatsoever, just flouting the law. Ralph and I were up there at a hearing testifying on bailouts to the auto companies. You know the statute, the bailout statute says money can go to financial institutions? I remember looked at General Motors and Chrysler and said, they look like auto companies to me, financial institutions. As bad as the bailout was, it was done in flagrant disregard of the law. Again, it's that kind of, something needs to be done. Just go ahead and throw money at it, you know, to the people who already have the power or whatever. Ralph told me, and I agreed, that the greatest concept in the history of civilization is due process of law. The greatest idea ever invented. And that's what we've lost. That's the earmark of civilization. Now process doesn't count for anything. Oh, who cares? Just get it done, and it doesn't matter whether you flouted all regularity. And unless we return to cherishing those words, due process, we're finished as a republic.
I just want to say one person had that thought that you did on the media, and now she has an audience larger than CNN every morning. Her name's Amy Goodman. So that's another answer to your question.
So, okay, sir, you've had your hand, and then these two over here.
Hi, Bob Reeder, Beyond the Humanist Legal Center. First of all, I'd like to thank AU for providing me two excellent interns the last two summers, and George Younger and Mike Martin. They did the primary research and writing of a couple of Amicus briefs. So, again, thank you, AU. I'd like to ask Mr. Fine, you started your presentation talking about white supremacy, 14th Amendment, et cetera. Would you care to comment essentially about Christian supremacy, which enables such things as the Pledge of Allegiance, In God We Trust, God Save the Sodom Court? Essentially, what we created is a system that blocks the First Amendment
Establishment Clause, sure.
Clause, as well as the Equal Protection Clause, by creating a majority group.
And will you just make a mental note of it, and we'll get some more in, and we'll come right back to you. Yeah. Yeah. So. Great. The right to organize. Thank you so much. And, sir.
First, I want to say this is probably the best way I could ever imagine to start out this semester, so thank you. I like Mr. Nader, I'm a registered voter in Connecticut, and I think we have a really good attorney general there. We have a bad senator there now. He's leaving, and the attorney general has really been a fighter for the Constitution and for consumers and the environment. Running for his seat, Richard Blumenthal. I just wanted to know if Mr. Nader shares my opinion of Richard Blumenthal. And I know there's been some talk about you running for Senate.
All right, so we got the Establishment Clause, we got the right to organize, and we got Connecticut politics.
Yeah.
So.
I think the Establishment Clause question, again, underscores how much political culture dominates legal interpretations. Even in the 2008 presidential campaign, when we had John McCain said this is a Judeo-Christian nation, and he said he would have reluctance to vote for a Muslim. And there have been those in Congress who have protested when Keith Ellison, who was a Muslim, was taking his oath of office on a Quran, said, hey, this can't be done. I mean, just grotesque violations of our adherence to Article 6 of the Constitution, which says there will be no religious test oath. This is a secular country. And the Supreme Court, in accommodating these realities of the cultures, is that, well, if you have a secular or reverential use of the word in God, then it really doesn't count as religion, even though that's utter nonsense. But it's because the court feels very reluctant to go against such an ingrained tradition of the United States, which, even though it's flagrantly, in my judgment, unconstitutional, why are you putting in God we trust, unless you're saying, yeah, this is a Christian, well, what is a Buddhist doesn't believe in God? What do they feel, that they're isolated? It just goes back to the fact that unless you and we change the political thinking, what we find acceptable or not, it's not going to make its way into constitutional law. I can guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, the Supreme Court is not going to bail us out. The Supreme Court is not. They didn't in Dred Scott and Sanford. They didn't in Korematsu. They maybe can put little speed bumps in the road, but they're not going to save this country. It's us, and it's you who take the leadership role. I want to just elaborate on what Ralph said, too. Leadership doesn't need hundreds and thousands. You know, the Bolshevik Revolution was run by Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky in an odd way, and Hitler didn't have huge masses behind him either. He was able to manipulate those. That's why never underestimate what one person can do. You know what Andrew Jackson said when he was asked what a majority is? Says, one man with leadership. One man with courage. Now, he should have said one man or one woman with courage, but he still gets honorable mention. Thanks.
Tell that to the Cherokees.
All right, so...
And the Seminoles as well.
Just to elaborate, this is a very important point Bruce made. The people who started taking on the tobacco industry, which included me years ago on non-smoking sections and airlines, you can't believe the abuse we took. And also, forget it. This is the most powerful industry in its own pursuit around. They own Congress. Look at, see the difference? The same with people who pushed for arms control. They would march down the street here or in New York and say, we've got to have a mutual inspection and take out these warheads incrementally. They thought they were crazy. What? Have Russians here supervising in sensitive areas the dismantling of warheads and have us over there? It's happening as you speak. That's what I mean. The blasphemy of today, commonplace of tomorrow. That helps you from becoming prematurely discouraged or disillusioned. I think Blumenthal will be one of the better senators, which may not be saying that much, but... He definitely will. He's had a lot of experience going after corporate wrongdoing and consumer advocacy. Unfortunately, he was going to take on Lieberman, and he would have beat him easily. He was 35 points ahead of him in the polls about a month ago. Now he'll go in 2010, and Lieberman will have another opportunity to elaborate his role as the leading political hermaphrodite in the U.S. Congress.
I think he was suggesting you might run against Lieberman.
Well, yeah. I don't know. The other thing, the question is on labor. Really, it's astonishing, isn't it, Jamie, about the labor unions, they have 18 million members, they've got a lot of money, they can get a lot of media, they can buy media, and they're for the checkoff, but they will never come out against Taft-Hartley. I've never been able to get them since the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, like an albatross around American labor. That's the reform, is to get rid of that and not just have a card check, but declare a human rights agenda for working people who are up against multinationals, for heaven's sake, who can send their jobs and industry to fascist and communist regimes overseas who know how to keep workers in their place, don't they, at 50 cents an hour. So... where are the labor unions? They're constantly saying we have other fish to fry, and you don't know where the fish are, or they don't want to embarrass Obama. They're the really ones who've fallen down on the job, and not just in this area, but in OSHA and other areas as well.
More questions. Yes, ma'am, and then to you.
Well, let me tell you a story that's not an exact analogy, but the issue had arisen as to whether or not there should be a punishment for lying to Congress to get us into war. You remember when Mr. Bush told us about the purchase of yellow cake from Niger and the weapons of mass destruction and the biological mobile weapons that were labs in Iraq and all those other things. So I got down with my friend Walter Jones He's a Republican from North Carolina, who, by the way, got the largest Republican majority in the last election. And we drafted an act called the Executive Accountability Act, which wouldn't seem to be startling. The fact that you'd actually have to have a law is rather incredible. But the gist of it was the president who knowingly lies about material facts to Congress and the American people to get authorization for war would be committing a felony. Now, you wouldn't actually need that if Congress exercised its powers. The people did, because James Iredell, he was one of the first justices sitting on the Supreme Court, and he was explaining the impeachment clause at the North Carolina ratification debate, and he's explained, well, listen, if a president lies to the Congress about a material fact to get them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do, he said, well, surely he'll be impeached and removed instantaneously. It's a very unambiguous statement, and he was very prophetic in anticipating what executive abuses might arise. But this Executive Accountability Act then came before Congress. There was a hearing. I testified, and Congress just shrugged, well, we don't want the president to be nervous about communicating to us. I said, well, you know, you have the sole responsibility of deciding on war or not. I said, we do? I mean, that's just wrong. And so this is the Congress of the United States. Robert Byrd introduced a companion piece in the Senate, but it hasn't gotten anywhere either. But when you have a culture that accepts with equanimity that they can lie not about just whether it's the employee checkoff card or public financing that he'll accept until he won't accept it, and state secrets until he changes his mind. But lying to get our men and women to die for war, and they yawn and are indifferent at it? My gosh, what kind of country have we come to? This is, you know, and I don't want to exaggerate, this is Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany. Just tell the big lies out there, and who will care? It doesn't matter anymore. And this is where the real danger comes in the political discourse has so become so degenerate. Is when people in politics equate truth with political expediency. And what's truth one day is falsehood the next day. Depends upon who's helping them, who's hurting. When Harriet Myers and Karl Rove said, we're not going to obey those subpoenas to testify, then all the Democrats said, that was terrible. The Republicans said, okay. But when Denise Rogers said, no, I'm not going to show up because I'm the social secretary, the Democrats said, okay, the Republicans said, no, now you're violating the Constitution. That is, when the politics is so dominant over reality and anything like statesmanship, but what's good for the country? No, that's heresy. What's good for the country? That doesn't matter. It's what's good for you and me and the party. Then the politics really becomes totally ineffectual. You're not even having a conversation. Because you're not talking about the same sense of reality and what the country is about.
Yes.
Well, one of the problems, and I think I testified with your colleague on the WTO. Yeah, Lori, who's great, with the whole idea is that the current trade agreements clearly should be treated as treaties. We are yielding authority to interpret our own trade laws to foreign entities. No control. We don't pay their compensation. They're not accountable to any American official. We don't appoint them. We can't remove them or anything like that. And fast-tracked is just a way to accelerate congressional deliberation without the options of amending and skirting the obligation that if you have a treaty, you need a two-thirds vote in the Senate and to scale back the two-thirds into simple majorities. Now, fast track in itself, just the idea that you want to force Congress to move forward with certain procedural rules so you can't add amendments, that was done when they had the military base closings as well, when you want to force Congress to take an up or down vote without permitting so many stalling taxes procedurally. That's really an internal congressional decision. I think it's foolish. My idea is the more checks you have for government action, the better overall. But my basic objection is, flouts the treaty obligation to get two-thirds of the Senate to vote these kinds of arrangements.
And by the way, this is an example of the lack of foresight by the framers. They couldn't have foreseen everything. They did a pretty good job. They could never believe that a branch of government would voluntarily give up its authority. Therefore, they provided no remedy. There is no standing for us to sue 300 million Americans. If we try to, it will be considered a political question and thrown out, even if we get some standing. And so basically what we have here is an international system of autocratic governance called WTO or NAFTA that can pass rules that we have to obey. These are not voluntary anymore, as they were earlier with early GATS, that we have to obey on penalty if we violate them. And so we cannot challenge the Geneva dictates of WTO and U.S. courts. We can't change our federal regulatory process because they circumvent them. So if we were proposing the airbag today, it would be considered a non-fair trade barrier unless we got the consensus of all the other signatories to the WTO. So you see how it comes home every day. Now, there was one challenge to the WTO, and it was thrown out, wasn't properly brought, but there hasn't been one since, which is rather strange. Why aren't there regular challenges here? There's certainly case or controversy. So imagine, this is, every treaty involves a loss of sovereignty. But this is the greatest surrender of local, state, and national sovereignty in American history. And it was done under a fast-track, no amendment, limited debate. The House debated more their raises in a longer period of time than this. And it's not being challenged in the courts. And if it was, the WTO people would probably win. You see how it becomes more, you know, the Constitution becomes let down, let down, let down. We don't have a remedy to challenge constitutional violations. You are penalized more if you illegally park across the street than a federal official violating your constitutional rights.
A lot more.
So this is a huge gap where even the phrase constitutional crimes, right, Jamie, what does that really mean under the federal criminal code?
Yeah.
So that's what gives the people like Bush, Cheney, Obama, and others this huge area above the law that they can get away by violating the law.
Time for two more questions. Yeah.
Well, what I try to do is suggest that in a democracy, there is one affirmative obligation. We all probably read, maybe not today anymore, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and you know everyone has a moral right to do whatever they want as long as they don't injure anybody else. But that's deficient when it comes to democracy. That's a collective effort. If I'm not looking at a Bush violation or Cheney or an Obama, that means you're more in danger than if I was looking, because it's collective vigilance that protects democracies from descending into tyrannies. And therefore, you can't tell somebody, oh, you can just chill out. You're endangering me. I want your eyes and ears protecting me just like I'm protecting you, because I'm looking at what government's doing and protesting if they're invading civil rights, civil liberties, etc. And that's the only way that I know you can get somebody to say, well, it is simply, no, don't read John Stuart Mill. He didn't get it all right. He got a lot right, but that's wrong. You, if you want to stay in a democracy, you have a moral obligation to participate and be civically accountable, because you're endangering others. You don't have that right. If you want to go live someplace else, you know, that's mm-hmm. fine. But if in democratic dispensation, we all hang together, we all hang separately.
You know, let's bring it down to scale. 1 million committed people with the amount of time equal to what dedicated bird watchers provide for their hobby is all you need in areas of such gross violation with a lot of public sentiment already on your side. There's a lot of public sentiment against what Bush and Cheney did in the wars and so forth, regardless of the lack of an opposition party to speak mm-hmm. of. So as Lincoln said, with public sentiment, you can do everything. Without it, you can't do very much. So where are you going to get the 1 million people? That means money. You have to have organizers, every congressional district. You have to have gathering places. And this is why I was driven to write a work of fiction called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, because the thesis of what would happen if 17 enlightened, older, super rich Americans put money and muscle behind all these popular movements. What would happen? What if they put $15 billion in? What would it take to organize the people of this country to have to change the political culture and put the heat on the two parties and what Bruce was talking about? 20 million? 50 million? That's peanuts for people like George Soros, Ted Turner, Warren Buffett. And if we don't think of this kind of reallocation of monetary resources, where you have money and muscle crossing the aisle from the oligarchy to populist missions that have a large degree of popular support, but they have no organizers, they have no means, they have no ways to get their views translated into the political and electoral arenas. So that's why we have to imagine. The key thing you want to resist in law school is depressing your imagination. Because if you depress your imagination, you depress your expectation level. The most effective form of control worldwide in world history is control expectation levels of people.
It looks like our final question, Miriam Arnjan.
That's a very important project. It'll bear fruit in not too many years. And that's just an example. There are a lot of small starts that can become big. For example, don't you have a chapter of the Lawyers Guild here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they wouldn't object to more members and more effort. Mm-hmm. That's one. The second is you link with other law schools so that you can come out with pronounced statements. Nationally, you can do that now much more easily, as I said, with the internet. There are a lot of things that can be done in terms of starters. Starter initiatives are what generate leaders. Everything starts small, right? I mean, almost every social justice movement starts with one person saying, no, this is wrong. So, it's interesting that people get discouraged precisely because they don't understand that point in history. Mm-hmm. So what am I? I'm just one person. Can't change anything. Well, that's all it's ever started for major change. Last point I want to make is one with expectation levels. Eugene Debs' famous statement when he was asked at the end of his career by a reporter, what's your greatest regret, Mr. Debs? And this was in the 1920s. And he said, my greatest regret is that under our Constitution, the American people can have almost anything they want, but it just seems like they don't want much of anything at all. And if you just compare the state of living in Western Europe with the poverty and misery here and the lack of health insurance and all the rest of it, you can get what he means. Expectation levels. You are on the front lines of raising expectation levels about what constitutional rule of law really means in everyday life. That's your imperative.
If I could end, I guess, on a little bit higher note, my belief is that the finest constitutional hour of the United States came in our lifetime when I was at the Justice Department watching Richard Nixon leave on that helicopter and saying, you're not president anymore. The president says it doesn't necessarily mean it's legal. Because it represented the culmination of the people who, even without the money, they wrote in 2 million telegrams after the Saturday night massacre when Archibald Cox was fired. You know why they held the hearings in Watergate? It was because the people demanded it. Said, we don't have kings here in the United States. We only have presidents in the United States. And when John Dean was testifying, I know every single TV screen was riveted on John Dean. He was talking about presidential cover-up and crimes. Every single one. They weren't looking at video games or anything else. And it was the American people who drove it and said, we care about the Constitution, even with the most powerful man in the world, more than just comfort, etc. It can be done. That was 1973. I can remember right now, October 20th, I can remember. That was the day he was fired. I can still remember the breathlessness on the White House lawn. This is a burning of the Reichstag. And the American people stood up and said, it's not the burning of the Reichstag. There's no reason why it can't be done again. It's just a matter of will and spirit. Never give up, and you'll succeed.
But look, they may be asking you this question in their mind. It's been 35 years. The crimes of Richard Nixon are picayune compared to the crimes of Bush, Cheney, and nothing happened. Now, what has changed in 34 years?
My view is that has changed as we've become a complete empire. One of the worst things that happened in an odd way, when the Soviet Union disintegrated, we had this swagger. We're the superpower of the world. We get to go any place. No one can destroy us. No one can inhibit our ability to try to reduce our risk to nothing. And that is what we have acquired, this empire mentality. Everything is subordinated to the national security state. You know, Osama goes on and he has another videotape, and then who knows, 50,000 new companies will build special detectors and we'll go crazy and we need to expand the definition of enemy combatant. That's what we have to resist. It's an admonition Edmund Burke gave about the British Empire, which went unheeded. He said, I fear that we will become too powerful. I fear that we will think we can exercise our power without trying to aggrandize and oppress others. And he was ignored, and we know what happened to the British Empire. That is what we have to guard against, our own power that makes us arrogant. And I think that's where we're different now. The oddest way is that the Soviet Union did impose an intellectual discipline on us. I mean, to some degree, the civil rights movement began because after the war, we figured we're never going to get black Africa unless we have some reforms there, because the Soviets were going otherwise. And that's why the challenge is a little bit greater, but it can be done.
Let me just say, you can take issue with many things that were said from left, right, or center, whatever. I think nobody can dispute the constitutional patriotism of these two men who really have devoted their lives to the rule of law and justice in our country. So please salute Bruce Fein and Ralph Nader.